Hi, everybody, film fans, anime fans, cartoon fans. My name is Mark Chaffardini. I am the founder and editor of Go See Talk, and we'd like to welcome you to the next episode of the Go See Talk podcast experience where, oh my, look up in the sky. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it is a fantastic composer who goes by the name of Frederick Wiedemann, who is so steeped in DC properties and mythology. You wouldn't be surprised if they're going to do a comic book about him pretty soon. So we're excited to find out about his origin story, how he got into music. But first, why don't we just welcome him to the stage? Step up to the podium, Mr. Frederick Wiedemann. How are you today? How's things in your world?
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you. Everything's going great in my world. We're, you know, just doing my thing day in and day out, and I couldn't imagine doing anything better. So all good on this front.
Excellent, excellent. You know, it's it seems like a very weird time to make music because I'm not saying that there are direct parallels between people who run websites or podcasts and musicians, but the availability to get hold of entry-level and prosumer electronics just kind of levels the playing field. But how is things in your world? How do you navigate the world of composing? How do you use your tools to sort of make the most of it? Because I can only imagine how quickly a turnaround would be for a cartoon or a TV show. But how do you like to work?
Well, you know, you touched on a couple of very interesting things here in terms of how technology has leveled the playing field for a lot of us composers. And while that is true, you know, back when I started in 2004, when I was assisting composers, people had machine rooms full of gear and cables and stuff. And it was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars of worth of stuff, gear, just in that, just to be somewhat industry compatible with what other people were doing. Now you really don't need to do that anymore. I'm currently working on a laptop, the new M1 Max, you know, that new MacBook Pro that came out that is so incredibly powerful. I'm literally running my entire system on that one thing. And I have my couple of audio, you know, physical audio devices here to record my small little things in my room. But it really, that's really it. And I can do everything I want to do plus more. It's really an amazing time. And yeah, I think it's become a lot easier to become industry standard and industry ready for young composers to basically buy this stuff. But at the end of the day, that'll only get you this far. You know, you might have the tools, but doing the craft, getting a score done from start to finish, understanding and navigating through this very complex web of people that are involved in a movie, you know, that all that comes with a lot of experience. So, but in any case, how I work is, yeah, I have a home studio. I've always worked at home, which has, you know, was a nice little, it benefited me greatly when the COVID pandemic happened, because I could just kind of carry on my own thing. I didn't have to, you know, exit a studio somewhere outside or anything like that. I just kind of kept working in my little bubble here. And yeah, I wouldn't really want it any other way. I like being around when my kids are around and my family. I like popping out of the studio, helping my wife doing something, or, you know, watching the kids while she goes to work or something like that. So yeah, that's basically it. And I'm in here. I have my little computer that is now has become a portable rig. You know, whether I intended that or not, but I could literally take my computer now and go to Germany, visit my parents or my in-laws in Korea, and since set up my shop there and probably be up and running within a day with my gear. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, that's basically it. So I have two assistants that work both remotely in their own studios. They have compatible systems on their end, so we can share files easily. And yeah, it's basically a three-man show. And with all that, we get all this work that we're doing right now done.
One of the scores that I've listened to for decades and means a lot to me is Bill Conti's The Right Stuff. And it was put out by Varez on vinyl a couple of years ago. And there's some fantastic liner notes written about that. But one of the things I gleaned from that was he was actually two steps away from being on vacation. He had his bags packed and he got the call to do it. And so he literally had to drop everything. But the way you describe it, you know, you could take your laptop and just work remotely. I mean, it's amazing how the landscape has changed. And I'm actually, I have a career in architecture, and I've noticed the parallel. Wow. Because what we do is in 2020, you know, our companies had to, because of the pandemic, we had to overnight transition to a digital workspace. And it's amazing how quickly you're able to do that and function. And I mean, you know, you said something earlier about having the tools, and to quote the immortal Ernie Hudson, you have the tools and you have the talent. So the good thing is you're able to take the two and marry them, and that's how you flourish and make it in this. It's kind of a very, very cutthroat industry, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah, no doubt, and overly saturated. I mean, I feel like when I graduated Berklee College of Music, there was very few universities offering film scoring as a major or, you know, as a degree of some sort. Now, almost every big university has some sort of media music thing or game music or whatever, anything. So you have all these young people coming to LA now with degrees in film scoring that weren't there before. You know, earlier, 20 years ago, it was basically just musicians that decided, hey, I'm going to get into composing. And then they would just start assisting other people and learn the ropes that way. But now it's a little different. You have this, you know, big swarm of people coming out here trying to do this. And, you know, it's challenging for them. I'm trying to help as many as I can. A lot of them reach out to me because I don't know why they find me online and they send me an email offering their help and assistantship. And I always try to help when I can. And especially when that person is somehow a mutual friend or comes recommended by somebody. But yeah, it's not easy, you know? And I feel especially bad for these young people that are from overseas, like I was when I was coming here 20 years ago, because the landscape of visas and work permits for especially composing fields have kind of gotten a lot more tricky and difficult to navigate through for those people as well. So wish them all best of luck, but it's not an easy task.
So basically what Freddie is saying is, I'm here now, I'm doing it. Good luck to everybody else.
Well, here's the thing. Basically, it's never been easy. I mean, you know, I'm not saying for me, it was a breeze. It was really difficult for me too. We had our own set of challenges, you know, visas too. I mean, I had to buy, I think I went through 6 or 7 different visas before I finally became a citizen. It's an endless process. They don't make it easy for you if you're coming from another country. But in any case, I always tell, I used to teach at USC at the film scoring department, and they always ask me for advice, you know, at the end of the semester, like, how do you make it? What's the trick? Like, how do you get to the next level? What's the thing that you should be focusing on as a young composer? And I always told them, like, you got to really want this. You can't just do this on the side or because you kind of think it's fun, or you're doing this as a side hustle where you really want to do performing or songwriting or something like this. From my experience, you have to be really, really committed to this task and this profession, that you're willing to give it your all and work your butt off, basically, you know, working your way up through the ranks with all these various people that are already successful. And then I have no doubt you'll get to some place that you will enjoy in the future. But everybody I've met, I've known that kind of did this sort of, yeah, it's kind of fun, I kind of like composing, it's cool, I enjoy it. It's they realize how hard it is and how much work and effort I have to put into this, and how much suffering, I guess, to that they just don't think it's worth it. So you have to really want this. And I think the world is your oyster.
Well, you know, you remind me of when you mentioned 20 years ago, there's a band called Two Steps from Hell, which was very popular, and they made really great epic cinematic music. Feeling. Yeah. And big the funny thing is that they that was what they wanted to do. They weren't exactly composing for film. They were just doing things. And I guess they seem to me like an anomaly. It's not like they became composers by just, you know, happenstance, or film composers by happenstance, but it seemed like they were doing something that they like, and it found an audience, and it sort of found its way into trailers and, you know, people making fan edits and stuff like that. So I think in that respect, those people were kind of doing it as a hobby, but side parallel. It would just be funny if more people had this, you know, like Bandcamp, for instance. Bandcamp is sort of a hobbyist, amateur, independent platform. And so little by little, these people may get plucked out or may get found. Whereas, like you're saying, people are actually going to school and trying to go the more traditional route. And that seems like a big bottleneck. So it's not to say that's the wrong approach, but there's multiple ways to sort of make it. and there's no really wrong
absolutely
way.
No, and that's a really interesting topic. I mean, I have friends that, you know, there's a very, very prominent and successful trailer composer, good friend of mine, his name is Mark Petrie. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's written some of the biggest trailers you've seen in the past years, you know, from Avengers to God knows what.
Oh, awesome.
And yeah, he's doing extremely well with that. And it's always a funny thing to define, like the definition of success. Like, what do you think is success? Is it being financially stable? Is it being really rich? Is it having an Oscar? Is it having an Emmy? Is it, you know, or is it going in your studio, doing what you actually care for and enjoy, and making a living off of it? That's, you can define success in whatever way you want. But he studied film scoring, and he ended up being one of the best and most successful trailer composers in LA. And he's enjoying it, as far as I can tell. So I would say he's extremely successful, even though he's not doing scoring movies or TV shows, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of different avenues you can go. You can become a really successful orchestrator or score mixer with this kind of education. You can become a, you know, top of the line music editor and handle 13 shows at the same time. There's all sorts of things you can do with this. It's not just composing for movies and TV. For sure. Yeah.
Well, Freddie, why don't we use the segue or the sort of intro about comic books to get to know your origin story? You talked about coming to the States, but why don't we get your backstory on how you first came into music, and tell us about yourself.
Yeah. So I've always been surrounded by music, not in a sense that my parents were musicians, but they always listened to classical music. I cannot remember a single Sunday where I wouldn't come downstairs for breakfast and there wouldn't be Beethoven or something playing, Brahms, who knows what. My dad was a big classical music fan. So I was always exposed to it. And I think that's what led me, at the age of 6, I really wanted to learn the violin, because I had been listening to this music this whole time and I liked it. So I told my parents, I want to learn to play the violin. So I did that for, I think, a good 8 years. And then, you know, was a teenager and became a little bit too cool to walk around with a violin case. So I transitioned directly into rock guitar, which was, one of the best decisions of my life, really, even though my parents were slightly concerned about this development, that I now want to play punk music. But what happened was I learned the rock stuff, like playing power chords. I don't know if you know much about guitar, but playing power chords is a fairly simple thing to learn. It doesn't take long. Like within a year, you can pretty much play any song in the charts on your own. It may not sound perfect, but you can get through every single song. You know all the chords, no problem. So once I had mastered that, my guitar teacher said, you know what, now that you know how to do this, why don't we learn jazz? And I was like, okay. I'm not really that interested in this music, but by all means, teach me. And then that's when just suddenly my world exploded, because he came out with some music theory that was, it's part of learning jazz performance, is you need to understand what you're doing. There's a lot of like theory and mental work involved while learning jazz. So suddenly I dove into this world of harmony and composition and voicings. And suddenly it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And that's when I got completely hooked on music and creating music. And parallel to that, I had bought my first soundtrack, which was Dances with Wolves by John Barry, back when I was 12 years old. And that was my first soundtrack where I discovered that that's even a job. Like, people do that for movies. I read his name, John Barry, and I'm like, who is this? Who is John Barry? Was he part of this movie? And then I learned composed by and conducted by, and I'm like, huh. So this people do that. And then of course I went to the public library in Germany where I grew up in, and I found the soundtrack section, and they had like 10 scores. I think I got all of them. It was Legend by Jerry Goldsmith, that unicorn movie with Tom Cruise. They had a strange, so some weird Hollywood compilation album, which was full of Basil Poledouros, also Goldsmith, James Horner, Willow, and all those things, like these old late 80s, early 90s scores. And that's when I just completely was hooked on film music as well as composing. And that, you know, and then I started to just write stuff on the piano and at some point, I think I'm this interesting generation where I grew up for most of my youth without a computer in the house. And then when I was 16, my parents bought their first one. Of course, I instantly bought Cubase and a small keyboard and started messing around on my own. So those were my first couple of composing experiences on a computer. And then I met a neighbor of one of my back then girlfriends who was a film composer. He worked in his apartment and he worked on German TV shows. And that's the first time I actually saw somebody do it and how it's done. And then that's when I think I was like 16 or 17. And I was like, this is it. This is all I want to do. And from that point on, it's been pretty much my main focus to become a film composer and not do nothing else. So there was very little distraction, which was great because I could finish high school. Then I lived in England for a year because back then Germans had to do either military service or social service. This was mandatory. So I did my social service in England. And then right after that, went to Berklee College of Music, got my bachelor's, went straight to LA, worked for a bunch of composers for a couple of years before I went on my own. Yeah, and then that's basically it. And my first movie, which led to many other things, was Return to House on Haunted Hill, this little Warner Brothers horror film, which was, you know, a fun little horror flick. And yeah, from that point on, it just kind of snowballs into all these different connections and people that you've come across and that you stay in touch with. And, you know, fast forward, what, 15 years later, here I am doing my thing. So yeah, that's basically it. For me, wanting to be a film composer that's early and then focusing on just that is kind of rare. I've never met many people that knew that this early, that this is what they wanted to do. But I guess it helped me focus and just stay on track with that.
Well, it's great that you told me about the violin, because I saw an interview with you where you talked about learning jazz guitar at 18, 16, 18. So I was, which to me, when I heard that, it seemed like a little late to start picking up music, but the fact that you picked up violin so much earlier, you had already had that in your system.
I already knew how to read music and all that, yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, one of the things that's very, I would say, a tough barrier to life is when you tell your parents what you want to do for a living. And because the arts tend to be a hit or miss, mostly nonprofit, mostly striking out. I guess, who was the biggest source of support, and what kept you motivated as you progressed?
Well, you know, my parents were, obviously, I think I give them huge credit for letting me do this, because if you have to understand the circumstances, my dad's a doctor, he's an orthopedic surgeon. My mom is a geography and German teacher. So none of them are artists or musicians by any sense. So and also in Germany, if you're a German citizen, you go to any university for free. It's all state funded. So,
oh, didn't know that.
Yeah, university is like public schools. You just go. And you know, you can choose any of the ones you like. It's not like in America where everything's private and 50K plus per semester. So for their son, who, let's face it, wasn't a very good guitar player, I was okay, but I was by no means a wunderkind where people thought, oh man, he's going places with this. You know, I was doing okay. I was enjoying myself. Same with composition too. Obviously I was, you know, not hyper talented or anything like that. I just enjoyed it. And I was extremely passionate about films and film music already. And for me to come to them and say, listen, I want to do this thing called film scoring. I know we don't know anybody who does that, nor have you probably ever heard of anybody doing this, but I want to do this. And it's going to, they teach it at Berklee in Boston, and it's going to cost you, you know, 100 grand to study there. So let me do this, please. So of course, their first reaction was like, wait a minute. What? What is this you're talking of? So, and I didn't need to convince them a lot, actually. They pretty soon, my dad looked at his, you know, finances and said, yep, you know, we can do it. It's not easy, but we can figure this out. And I knew this was quite the strain on my dad's wallet, you know, given, I mean, he was doing okay, but studying abroad with them with living expenses and me not being able to work while I'm a student, that all of that is, you know, you need to literally pay for the whole thing in cash. And I didn't have a scholarship either. So knowing that, what motivated me was, first of all, their trust to let me take this path, even though it's in their eyes, must have been extremely far-fetched and abstract to be studying something like this. You know, if you don't know anybody who does this profession and your kid comes to you and wants this much money to do it, it's like, I don't know what I would do. I have little kids too. I hope I'm as open-minded as they were. But what I did is I spent my year in England that I did after high school, and I studied all the Berkeley textbooks and then basically skipped two semesters when I started there. So my first call from Boston was to my dad saying, "Hey dad, I just saved you two semesters." And he was like, "Way to go, son. Up high." So that was basically my big motivator was like, I have to make my parents proud. I have to do this. And at the same time, my own little fire and passion for this particular type of music that I really wanted to learn how to write. Yeah. And then that's, you know, with all those combined, later in, when I was further into Berkeley, I got a couple of scholarships. So that helped too in the end. But I did feel the pressure, you know, to make this work, because it's something that was just a very unusual thing for a kid to want to study. So,
well, similar to you having children, I have a 7-year-old daughter, so I'm now mentally, financially, spiritually trying to prepare for when she says, yeah, I want to be a cosmonaut or whatever it is. You know, it's like, okay, well, that came out of nowhere, so let's try. Mm-hmm. Let's plan for that. So, well, but, you know, having grown up on classical music and finding Dances with Wolves at such a young age, you know, when you see something all put together, it can either be intimidating or seem perceptibly easy. But when you started working with these composers, and I'd like you to name the people you started working with, what was it like seeing things from, you know, inside the machine, so to speak, you know, trying to build something? You know, you don't get to Dance with Wolves overnight. It's got to manifest.
Absolutely not. And neither do you get there after a Berklee College education. It was a great education. I met a lot of very, very good people that I'm still very close with and that have helped me a great deal getting my foot in the door here in LA. But yeah, the real school is really just being in the trenches with somebody who's done this before. I always recommend every young composer, you know, find somebody to work for, be an assistant, be an intern, do something, just watch them do it, because it is such a complex, crazy process that you can't possibly learn how to deal with this in school or by reading books. It's really something you have to be part of. So I started working for, my first job was an internship with this composer, Joel Goodman, who does mostly documentaries. And when that came to an end, I got a job working for a composer called John Frizzell, who you may know. He's done Beavis and Butthead Do America, Office Space. He worked with James Newton Howard on Dante's Peak and many, many movies and TV shows. You know, he's had an amazing career. So I got to work for him, and I was for, you know, the better part of three, almost 4 years, his sole assistant. There was nobody else there. So literally everything that happened, I was part of. I saw the meetings, I saw the music reviews, I was taking notes, I was, you know, helping with editorial issues and whatnot. So it was, that for me was my school. To this day, I'm kind of adapting his way of organizing music, especially on a complex feature film, because it's just, there's so many pitfalls and so many ways you can get into huge trouble merely from an organizational point of view. So I've learned a lot about just to, you know, keep my ducks in a row, know where everything was, being able to backtrack when things go, you know, when they say, can I hear version one again to this cut? Then you're going to be able to pull that up and make it happen. And so, yeah, that was for me the main experience. I've never really counted, but I must have worked with him on at least 15 feature films and, you know, several multi-season TV shows while I was there. So, you know, hundreds and hundreds of minutes of music was pushed out of the door in his studio. And that was my school. I learned everything there. You know, there's nothing more priceless than being in a room with these super high-end executive producers from big studios and then watching this composer, you know, do a show and tell and get cues rejected, get them approved, get the praise or not, and then see how he deals with that and how he navigates through this, especially when there's multiple people involved, which every film has. So yeah, it's a path I highly recommend, because once you're done with that and you're through that and you've spent a few years being in that chair, you're ready. You know, when I got my first movie, it was smooth sailing, because I knew exactly what to do. I knew exactly where to start. I knew I knew how to budget for a score. I knew what they cost for an orchestra, how to do that. You know, I understood Eastern Europe versus LA versus London, what all that meant, because I had been to all those places with John. So, you know, it was just, I was ready. And I wouldn't have been right out of Berkeley. If they would have given me that film right at, you know, a day after graduation, I would have been like, I don't even know what to do first here. You know, I just, no idea. So it's hugely advantageous to go through something like this.
Well, you hit on something that I hear a lot, and actually more frequently. Maybe, you know, I've been running this site for 13 years, but maybe I just hadn't paid attention to it. But, you know, the fact that what you do is part of a creative process, and creative tends to involve multiple individuals. You know, you're not in a silo just doing stuff for yourself. This isn't Freddie's Wonderland of music. So managing the relationships, being in the room with the director or the producer, hearing the feedback and really listening, because at the end of the day, you're commissioned to do something that somebody else wants. So, you know, you might want to push something one way, but if they go, no, I want to hear this, like, okay, we'll try it both ways, or whatever it is. And so, you know, last thing you want to do is just shove something down somebody's throat that they don't want. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, ego has no room in this industry whatsoever. If you're a composer, you're working for the producers, you're working for the director, you're working for the film, and that's the only thing you're worried about. If you want to write something you want, you write a symphony. Then nobody gives you feedback. That's okay. But don't be a film composer expecting to be able to do what you want at all times. You know, there's often, thankfully, I work with plenty of filmmakers that appreciate my point of view and my perspective and my sensibilities. Like sometimes they'll be in here and saying, I kind of like this temp, but I wonder what you would do this. And then I go, well, this is what I would do. And then I give them something that aesthetically speaks to me as a better approach. And then, you know, more often than not, they say, you know what, this is better. Or they don't, and then we go the other way. You know, there's always you need to have somebody, obviously, who's open-minded enough to even listen to other ideas. There are some directors that are very particular, and that's fine too, because it's their vision that you're trying to realize. And they want the audience to leave the theater with a certain feeling of emotion that when the credits start rolling, and it's your job to accomplish that. Not what you want the people to feel, but what the creator of this project, the mastermind of this film, TV show, whatever it is, had in mind. And I find both extremely rewarding, quite honestly. If I am able to give him what he wants and he's super happy with his creation, that gives me as much joy as if I contributed something completely original that they say they appreciate, that fresh approach that they didn't think of before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, you remind me of, I was speaking to Daniel Pemberton about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, and he had...
Love his stuff.
I love me too. Everything. But he was doing the trial of the Chicago 7, and yeah. there's something in the beginning to where there's what they call audiovisual counterpoint. So you're seeing kind of newsreels of the war in Vietnam and destruction and chaos, but the music that's happening is this kind of beach blanket, a go-go. It's very hot, peppy, and feels kind of like the Beach Boys got a hold of it. And so I said, you know, Daniel, who, you know, how did you, what was the discussion to have that, that counterpoint? And he goes, well, that was Aaron Sorkin's idea. And so that, you know, like sometimes you just don't think that, yes, like you're saying, it's the director's vision. They come in most times with a temp, or they're writing to something with something in mind. And so now they're bringing in these professionals to help fulfill that vision. Whereas, you know, maybe you or I or Daniel might have not done that peppiness. You want to play up the sort of newsreel footage that's happening, but the director said, I want this. And that's, you know, that's all she wrote. So anyway, a long-winded relating to what you're talking about. So.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It is very interesting. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we jump into, let's see. In the interview that I had watched, you also talked about learning to mic certain instruments. And that got me thinking about how it's less, at least from an outsider's perspective, it's less about writing a really catchy five-note theme or something that really... you know, grabs your attention, but you know, there's so much that really goes into it. how you mic an instrument, what instruments you use, how you process the sound. So when you start with an idea in your head, I guess, how long does it take to really find out if it's working, and how do you, you know, add to it, subtract, and finally get something you're happy with?
Well, it varies. Sometimes I'll literally be out with the kids somewhere and I have this idea of a tune or a theme, a melody, and I'll pull up my phone and sing it into the voice memos. There's hundreds of awfully sung things on my voice memo. My phone can never get stolen. It would ruin my career. But, you know, and then I will go in the studio at night to realize what I had just come up with out of nowhere. And I'm like, this is great. This is exactly what this film needs. I've already cracked it. I'm good to go. And then there's other times when it takes a long time, when you try and try and try and nothing's really quite sticking to it. And what happens then is I usually start talking to the editor, and we figure out something, especially when also the creative team, like the director, producer, etc., if they don't know either, if everybody's like, we don't really know what the sound of this film is or what the tone of this is yet. The most important thing before diving too deep into something creative is often to just find a good temp score, at least for one scene, you know, find a pivotal scene and then pull out some stuff from existing scores and just see, hey, is this a Cliff Martinez type thing? Or is it a, you know, orchestral Christoph Beck thing? Is it a John Powell percussive thing? What is it? And then often during that process, you find something, you go, wow, this is kind of interesting. Let's use that instrumentation as a starting off point. And then I have something to hold onto and I can start to develop ideas based on that. Yeah, so again, sometimes it just comes to you naturally. The film calls for something very specifically and then you do it and it matches and you're happy and you can carry on. And sometimes the film is a little tricky, especially when it's about when it's comedy. Comedy is probably one of the hardest ones because it can go in so many different places. You know, horror is easier because you have to do creepy, and you can do creepy in multiple ways, electronic, orchestral, more sound designy. That all works and it will always be creepy regardless of what you do. It's just a matter of what you aesthetically respond to more. For example, I did a comedy recently called Champions. It's a German film, and it was about a disgraced top league basketball coach who gets a driving under influence sentence to do social service because it's either that or jail time. So he chooses to do some social hours, and he basically has to coach a team of severely disabled, or, you know, I think mostly Down syndrome youth athletes in basketball. And they can't, you know, they can't catch a ball. They can barely throw a ball. It's that level of disability. And he's, you know, coming from the top league of basketball teams. And he's now sentenced for 6 months to teach those kids and bring them to this championship. And it was a comedy, but there was such a fine line to walk between, we cannot ever make fun of these kids because, you know, that's just how they are. But how the coach is dealing with it has to be slightly comedic without falling into the pitfall of, you know, making fun of anything of what the disability actors are doing. So that was a really tricky thing. And it took me a long time to figure that out. Like, what do you do? How do you keep it so it's people can smile at it, but not for the wrong reasons? And music was really the integral ingredient for that to happen, to go either this way or this way. So if you screw that up, you can make this whole film a disaster, or you can make it, you know, very appealing and successful. So it's subtle stuff like this that often takes a long time to really hit the nail on the head and say, this is right, this is what we need to do. So yeah, in that case, it took a while, but finally got there.
Well, yeah, well, that's good. That's awesome. I mean, that's one of the things about the any creative process. I mean, you very rarely turn in your first draft and say, okay, well, yeah, I'll see you on the golf course. You know, it takes revisions and things like that and input. Well, why don't we jump to the meat and the potatoes of this interview? You know, you've done at least six fantastic DC animated scores, and you mentioned talking with the editor and trying to find something to find inspiration in. One of the things I noticed about a lot of animation is that it, you know, scenes don't linger, you know, because everything's drawn by hand. It seems like it's there's a quick cut to it. So does that come into play when you're thinking about how to score a scene? Do you match things that closely? I guess really, how do you start to work on an animated property?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about animation, superhero stuff, and pretty much any animation that I'm working on, is it mostly has no temp music. It's just dry, especially the DC stuff. I don't think I've ever gotten anything delivered from the cutting room that had any music in it. So all I see is animation, sometimes not even final, and voiceover, and almost no effects even. So I don't even hear footsteps. I don't hear door handles. I don't hear explosions. Oh, wow. It feels so uninspiring and dry, because you're just watching this really strange, unreal looking thing, you know, that imagine you see a bunch of people walking and fighting and you don't hear any punches or efforts going, it's just silent. And you have to feel this, you know, this intensity in the scene. So it requires a lot of imagination. But yeah, you know, the DC stuff, especially, one of the big things that was brought on the table in the beginning was they want these to feel like real feature films. They don't want it to feel cartoony in any way. It's basically a live action movie, but drawn. That's what the feeling musically was supposed to be. So, you know, given that, you kind of just ignore the fact that you're doing animation. You just score the scene as it were acted by real people. And I think that's how I approached all of them down the road. So things move a little quicker, you know, I mean, scenes and close-ups and things like this, whereas in a live action one, you would maybe stand on a face close-up for 30 seconds and really get into the emotion of what this person is doing. In animation, these beats are faster, but the music still has to kind of give the feeling of this is just all part of this one big scene without, we call it Mickey Mousing, when you're hitting everything. You don't want to be doing that in those DC movies. That's the wrong thing to do. So yeah, they're basically treated like a real movie, start to finish.
Well, you mentioned John Powell earlier. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, I was done.
You mentioned John Powell earlier, and he does a lot of animated properties. But mm-hmm. what he was saying that is, he said that a lot of times that you kind of tend to stay away from really Mickey Mousing an animated property because it's already, in a way, it's already animated. You already know what's happening. You don't have to, you know, it's got a playfulness. You don't have to really oversell that. So I thought that was a nice point of view. But, yeah. You know, to sort of piggyback on the idea of how quick things move, I think what you're able to do is you're able to make an impact in such a small period of time. I mean, one of my favorite cues you've ever done is, it's called The Incident on the Flashpoint Paradox. And you don't even get to a full minute. I made it to 57 seconds and it's heartbreaking. So I want to commend you. And that's another reason I wanted to speak to you, is just to say that I appreciate and adore your work. But I mean, you know, that wasn't a symphony. That wasn't a suite. That was less time than making popcorn. And you're already just, you know, ripping my heart out. So how do you find this emotional core in such a condensed amount of time?
I think it's really the movie that's telling me to do that, because the scene is there, the emotional beats happen where they happen, and so I'm locked into that. So my job is to figure out a way to get there, you know, like you said, with no time or no lead up to really introduce an idea. You kind of sometimes just have to do it, because you only have a minute or 30 seconds, and then we cut back to Batman fighting somebody on a rooftop. So it's really about good time management and understanding where the beats are, where the theme needs to start versus end, you know. And then often, like, I often have this problem when I work on these movies where there's a scene as a build up to something and then the person starts crying and I'm like, okay, this is the point where everything falls apart for him, and then they cut away to something completely different and I have no time to do anything. And it's one of those things where I'm like, oh, just give me like 20 more seconds on his face so I can do like at least half a melody or four bars of something, because, you know, melodies are always the thing that will get you, that'll pull on the heartstrings more than anything else. And if you don't have the time and you just have time for this one chord and then you go back to, you know, some epic space battle, that you just can't fulfill really what needs to be done emotionally. But so that requires a lot of practice and skill to be able to still make it work, even though you only have this condensed amount of time to get to this point where it's emotional enough that the story still is told the way it's supposed to be told.
Well, you know, one of the cues that I really like the best is it's the end credits of The Death of Superman, because it just takes you on this journey. And that's when I really clued into your name. And I said, this guy knows what he's doing. So the one thing I really want to know is whether it is a creepy movie where you say it's all just mood and sound effects, or it's anything else. If you were to break down your economy, your production, what goes into 1 minute of music, whether it's moody or whether it's sweeping? Is there, you know, how much time, how much production, how many assistants, what goes into making 1 minute of music?
Oh my God, I don't think you can answer that question with a global number, because sometimes it's very, very little time because it doesn't need a whole lot. And if you're well prepared, you have a good template. You know, every project you do, or at least I do, every movie, for example, I spend a great deal, usually several days, just assembling the palette, you know, creating the sounds, often by myself, or, you know, finding them and then putting them in on my sequencer so that that's the sound of the film. So all that's already there. I know a lot of composers that don't do that, and then they spend hours just searching for sounds. And that's the time I don't really spend, you know, once I'm working. But yeah, I mean, when you're doing TV, for example, which I do a lot of right now, I do a lot of kids shows, you need to move fast. So there's no time to spend a whole day on a 1 minute of music and to tweak it and finesse it and really get it to be as perfect as you can. Like you would do, for example, for a bigger feature film that's heard in the theaters, where it really matters what every little bit sounds like. But so for TV, you kind of just go through it. You know, you do your 3 or 4 minutes a day, if not more. And it has to be that way because they need to mix these episodes every week and they have to get them done. So you can't really be messing around too much with time on those. But when I do a movie, often I spend an entire day on just 1 minute, just kind of try and error. We're deleting something, going back, maybe trying the other theme I wrote. Okay, that works better than slowly arrange it, then change the arrangement, then add some stuff. Then maybe I'll call my cellist and say, hey, can you play this in for me real quick? I need something that sounds real. And she'll do it, and then I'll get it back. I'll mix that in. And then I'll say, oh, this might be cool to present as an alternative with a clarinet instead on the melody. So I call my woodwind guy to do that. So, you know, on a movie, that's what you do. You deal with a minute like that versus a TV show where you just go bam, 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 bam. Notes, revisions, fixes, stems, upstage, and repeat. You know.
Okay. Well, you know, Steven Spielberg uses the term coverage wherever, when he makes a movie, he can just have somebody, you know, bend over and pick up a pencil, and it gives him a little more breathing room. So when you're preparing these, do you add a little extra wiggle room in for cutting? Do you add, you know, you mentioned the alternate. Do you do alternates as a standard, or are they just as it feels right to do an alternate?
Alternates really only if I feel like what they're asking me to do doesn't work, or if I do it and it works, but I suddenly have a better idea or another idea that is equally valid. It's usually a personal choice. Nobody usually asks me to give them options, but you know, sometimes, especially when you have people, directors or producers that haven't really dealt with music much before, they will ask for something. And then at the end of the day, it's your job as the composer to figure out, to give them what they need, not what they necessarily asked for, without making it seem like you're bypassing what they've been telling you. So in that case, I would say, I'm going to do what they want, and then I'll do what I think they should have. And to kind of illustrate, like, look, this is what you described to me, works, it's okay, but this is what I think it should be, and it would serve the film because A, B, C, D. And then usually that's, people go, you're right, this is interesting. I wouldn't even have thought of that. So in that case, I think alts are key to just communicating. Because often if you start to articulate that just with words to somebody who's not very musically savvy, it can just mean nothing to them, you know? So I think the best is always a presentation.
Well, I think that's extremely valid and beneficial to a project because, you know, I run into the same things where a client may ask me for, you know, a door design or something. And so what I like to do, I like to call it the show your math. You know, you could hold two things up and you say, well, pick one, but that's kind of lacking the story. There's no real reasoning to it. So you kind of say exactly, you know, give them the description, like you said, you know, you asked for this, but I still feel that there's something to value and let them decide. But
Exactly. I'm sure architecture is pretty much the same thing in that regard, especially when you're dealing with people that don't know anything about building houses or structures. Like, mm-hmm. I want something that looks like the Disney Hall, you know, and you're like, okay, I hear you, but
yeah. Practical, maybe not. You mentioned being assistant and working with composers as you came up. Who helps you now, and whether they're you worked with a conductor and orchestrator on Flashpoint Paradox. How do you lean on people who kind of help you but not necessarily do what you do or take the weight off your shoulders, so to speak?
Well, the only person that helps me and has helped me from day one is my wife, who's the conductor and orchestrator for Flashpoint Paradox and every other movie I've ever done. So she's the one, she's, you know, besides being a very renowned composer herself, she's always hands-on my orchestrations. She conducts whenever there's an opportunity so I can be in the booth producing it. And yeah, so she's my right-hand girl, so to speak, to get everything done. In terms of other mentors, there's really nobody anymore that does any help for me beyond what, you know, John did for me many, many years ago. So yeah, I'm pretty much on my own, but you know, with between the two of us, my wife and I, we get the job done, and it's nice because she's extremely good at orchestrating and conducting, where I am not. So that works out great because she gets to do that for me, and it always turns out fantastic, better than I could have ever done. And it stays in the family.
That's fascinating because I met my wife at an architecture firm, and she's an interior designer. And so sometimes we've never actually worked on a single project together except our house. But there'll be some times where I'll just ask her, hey, what do you think of this? And it's nice to have that common dialogue to where.
Oh, it's so good.
Like if I was to come home and I was a doctor or she was a, you know, landscape architect or something, like, we wouldn't be like, what are you talking about? But the fact that we can commiserate on the druthers or the successes of the day in the profession, that's a nice parallel to have.
You know, there's a lot to be said for that because there's always people that say, oh, you shouldn't marry a person in the same industry. It'll just cause competitiveness or something like that. And where that might be true in some cases, but in our case, it's just like you said, we'll be in the movie theater and she'll lean over and say, that was a great cue, you know? And I wouldn't be able to have this conversation with anybody except somebody who's that, you know, such a part of the industry too. So, and that'll, you know, praise or bitch about the score when the movie's done, or I don't know. It's I find it very rewarding and fun to have these conversations with somebody so like-minded, you know?
Well, sometimes what you do for a living can just consume you. So this question actually goes to both you and your wife. So what do you do to get away from the business? How do you guys relax? How do you, what's your victory dance when you have a score or a cue that got approved? Like, what do you do to just get away?
Well, if you look at my Instagram, you can see that I love to eat good food and travel a lot. So both my wife and I, we have our weekly date night, which I highly recommend, especially when you have kids, where we always find a new restaurant in LA and we try it out. So that's our little mini culinary adventure. And then we like to travel, mostly with the kids, you know, because they're old enough now. Mine are 8 and 11. And yeah, we just like to go to nice places and just relax there. You know, that's, they always say, work hard and travel harder. That's kind of what we do.
Never heard that, but that actually sounds like something I want to emulate.
It's a good motto. I would highly recommend it. You know, and you don't have it doesn't have to be, you know, we can only travel when the kids have vacations anyway from school, so it's not a lot. But when we do, we do a nice trip, like very nice hotel, far away, some cool exotic place. So we do, you know, that kind of keeps it different and interesting, and it's a nice reset because those are usually weeks that I don't work at all, while usually when I'm in here, I work all the time. So I need those breaks where I'm completely forced off my desk because, you know, like I said earlier, I work at home and then, you know, I'm obviously always tempted to, I'm just going to quickly do that thing. I'm just going to do that one more thing. I know it's 9 o'clock at night, I'm tired, but I'm just going to get this done so I don't have to do it tomorrow. So you kind of just constantly feel like you have to do something. So I need to leave the house to not do that.
Well, Frederick, we've had a one heck of a time getting to know you, and you hinted at the Instagram, but why don't you take us out of this interview and tell us where people can find your work, things you like to you do, and little channels to get to know more about you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all over the place. I'm on Twitter, for what it's worth. I'm on Instagram, too. Instagram's probably the most interesting place because you can see where I am. But yeah, I keep my Instagram updated professionally too. You can find me there. I think all of my handles are at Freddy Weedman. So you can just find me that way. Yeah, and I think, you know, people hit me up there too if there's any questions. So usually direct message works. And I have a homepage too, which kind of is obsolete at this point. I don't think anybody ever goes there, but it's myfullname.com. So you can go there too and see anything. I haven't updated it in like 3 years, but the communication portal still works. So if you wanted to reach out to me that way, that works too.
Okay. Well, hey, we had a blast finding out everything about you, and we look forward to catching up with you soon. So as we say all the time, we will catch you next time. Thanks,
good.
Freddy.
Thank you.